Hi, I'm Yusuf Zine. My latest TVO Today podcast is on how a Canadian ends up in a Chinese prison and if he's even alive. Listen and subscribe to Extradition. Available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Help TVO create a better world through the power of learning. Visit TVO.org and make a tax-deductible donation today.
I love going to shopping malls and just watching people walk around the shopping malls and do their very strange things. It's just as interesting as going to the forest in Indonesia and watching the orangutans or watching the ants in my backyard. We are weird animals. I'm Kristen Andrews. I'm professor of philosophy at York University and York Research Chair in Animal Minds. Philosophy is an approach to questions that don't have answers using purely scientific methods. It's a project that I think most people actually engage in all the time. Sometimes what philosophers have done in the past is they've assumed that the way the world is experienced by them is the same way for other people as well. And so they generalize from their own experiences to people across cultures, across genders, and as we know, that's not really the best way to figure out what people think or feel or how they experience things. And so we can ask these questions. Do chimpanzees plan for the future? When they remember things, do they replay them in their head the way we can like visually replay walking around through our house? Let's think of an example of a mother dolphin who has a young calf. The infant needs all kinds of care and attention. The mothers sometimes get tired. What has been observed in many different dolphin communities is that other females will come over and kind of babysit. They'll take the dolphin infant away from the mother, or they will come near the mother when the mother's with the infant, as she always is. And then the mother will sink down to the really deep part of the sea where the infant can't go. And sometimes she just stays there and just rests. And the other females are there to take care of the infant. So the mother knows her infant's fine and she can just get a little bit of a break. That's the sort of thing that we can look at and say, this looks like it's a kind of case of empathy. They're doing it because they know she needs a break. What's really funny about humans and human scientists and philosophers is that we seem to think that the animals of interest are the animals that are the farthest away from where we live. And so there's been this tradition in the West of traveling to Africa to study chimpanzees or to Indonesia to study orangutans. And when I've been to Indonesia to study orangutans, the people I talk to, the Indonesian people I talk to, say, why would you study the orangutans? I want to study the moose in Canada. I'm interested in squirrels. You have squirrels. Squirrels are so cool. Raccoons. I've heard all about raccoons. They're so interesting. And so we don't have to travel anywhere. We have animals all around us. Another thing that I think is very common for humans is to ask questions about animal minds when the animals are very big and exciting, the elephants and the dolphins and the chimpanzees and then corvids, ravens, you know, the smart animals, so-called smart animals. Why do they have these reputations? It's very strange. We've studied them, and so we found out they're smart. And there are all these animals we haven't studied. And so I was really interested in, for example, studying rats. Why am I going to Indonesia when I could study these rats in my backyard? And so we got some rats and investigated whether rats have culture. Turning to the question of culture in rats and cognition and sociality in rats made me really open my mind to thinking about culture and sociality and cognition in lots of different species where we don't normally think of them. So you might think that animals are just, you know, biologically destined to do the things they do. That birds just build nests innately, and that bees just go out and fly around innately, and they don't have to learn anything. And that learning is something special that we do, and chimpanzees and dolphins and elephants do. But actually, bees learn. They learn from each other. Ants learn. Fruit flies learn. If you give fruit flies, females, a display of other fruit flies, some with a little pink dot on them, some with a little blue dot on them, and they see other females mating with a pink guy, then they all want to have sex with pink guys and not the blue guys. So they learned that. They weren't born thinking pink painted fruit flies are hot. This kind of learning is widespread in the animal kingdom. Birds learn how to build nests. Lots of animals learn how to communicate. Meerkats will actively teach young meerkats how to eat scorpions. So you might think eating a scorpion is dangerous. You would be right about that. It's really hard for meerkats to learn how to eat a scorpion. And so they have teachers who deconstruct the task for them. The first time a young meerkat gets a scorpion to eat, they get a scorpion with a stinger off of it. So it's been already killed, the dangerous part's gone, and the juveniles can interact with it. As the juveniles get better, the teachers give them more and more complex parts of the scorpion to process. And with this kind of scaffolding, they then learn how to kill and eat scorpions on their own. And then they can teach it to the next generation of young meerkats. A scout bee will go and find a place where there's nectar or a new place to build a new hive, and they'll dance for this location. And they dance for an audience. So it's a social event. It's a communicative event. One thing that the audience can do is say, no, that's not a good place. I found a better place. So there's this signal called a stop signal that another bee can get up onto the stage, basically. They give a stop signal and kick the dancer off the stage, and then they start dancing for the other place. Grouper fish are big. They can't get into small crevices. Eels are small. They can get into crevices. A grouper can point to a place, hey, there's a fish down here, and then the eel goes down and gets it, and then they share the food. There's a lot of collaboration, a lot of interaction on the reef, in the savanna, in the forests, in the natural world. Intelligence is everywhere in the animal kingdom. What if we start studying consciousness in the worms? Because these systems don't have the kind of convoluted details and big brains that we have, we might be able to make a lot more progress in uncovering the mysteries of consciousness when we look for them in the small places, in the hidden places, hidden right in front of our faces in our backyards. We live in a multicultural society with other species and not just with other humans. We have to negotiate because there are differences. And there are all these cases of wild animals who sometimes run afoul of humans in a variety of ways. Sometimes it results in human death. Sometimes it results in animal death. It can be a real problem. And so how do we manage this? Lots of attempts to manage human-wildlife interaction between farmers and elephants in Thailand have involved methods like setting off firecrackers at the edges of the farms or making bee fences. To try to use bees to keep the elephants away. And none of this is working very well. The elephants still just are more secretive when they come, and they learn from other elephants, it seems, about how to better sneak up into the farms to raid the gardens. The question is there another way, instead of using brute force to keep the animals out, is there a way to negotiate with them that it would be better for them and for us, and we could be happier together if they would stay out of this area and maybe go to another area that was really beneficial. We interestingly know that wild animals are following these traditions that they've learned for over generations. The border between Germany and Czech, there used to be fences from the Cold War, right? Walls. The deer, to this day, appear to obey the wall barrier, even though there's no wall there. The only reason for this is that they've learned it from elders, generation after generation, that we don't go past this line. When we're doing conservation projects and trying to get animals to move in new places, sometimes gates are created Gaps in fences are created to try to allow animals passage, or green corridors are built to get fragmented populations of wild animals to be able to interact with each other and procreate. But we have to also be able to encourage animals to use these green corridors. So how do we do that? They haven't gone this way. We've never gone over here before. We've never gone through this doorway. How do we encourage them to go through this doorway? One way to do that is to really talk to one of the high-ranking individuals in the community. What I mean is show that individual that this is a really beneficial place to go, that there are goodies here. So reinforce that behavior on an individual basis so that the animal trusts us and then comes to trust that area. Now, if a high-ranking animal trusts that area, then other animals who copy that behavior will then also use this highway crossing or this green corridor or this fence gap. And so this is a way of negotiating and changing norms in an animal society for the benefit of the animals and for the humans. So I have a book that I think is a super fun book called The Animal Mind. It's an introduction to the philosophy of animal cognition. So if you're interested in questions about animal consciousness and about animal rationality, I discuss social cognition and how good other species are at understanding the minds of one another. I also really investigate the question about whether animals could be moral actors, whether they have their own moral codes that they follow. And look at this from the perspective of philosophy and philosophical theories of ethics. One of the things I think is really important about thinking about animal culture and animal social norms has to do with animal welfare for captive animals. So a lot of the animals that we kind of know best are captive animals. So the pets that live in our houses, animals that we might see in the zoos or who are in laboratories. Sometimes what looks like a harmful behavior or behavior that animals doing that we should stop might not be a behavior that we should stop in that population because that behavior might be significant to the animal culturally. And one of the reasons why the keepers and caregivers allow chimpanzees to play with feces and sometimes even eat feces is that the thought is that this might be a culturally important behavior for some communities of chimpanzees. Are there harms in eating feces? Well, sure, like there are pathogens. It's not something that we'd recommend, but there are also harms to lots of important cultural behaviors that humans engage in, right? When we pierce our body or tattoo our skin, we're also risking infection. Is it going to kill us? No. Is eating poop going to kill the chimpanzees? No. We have to be really careful that we're not kind of enforcing our own cultural norms onto other animal species or animal groups just because it makes us uncomfortable or it seems gross or somehow problematic to us. This is where it's important for us to develop empathy with the other animals and try to see from their perspective why this behavior might be important. You might think, like, what can I do to help other animals because I don't work at a zoo or work in a lab? But if you've got a dog at home or some other sort of a pet, you can do the same sort of empathic practice with your own animal that I've been talking about. For example, when I walk my dog, the walks are very, very slow or very, very fast, depending on what my dog Riddle wants to do. Sometimes he just wants to sniff everywhere and pee on every little piece of grass he can find. And I let him do that, not because I see value in peeing on the grass and sniffing everybody else's pee, but because it's important to him. And it's really important for dogs when they want to know what's going on in the neighborhood that they have this opportunity to sniff and smell. Imagine every time you went to answer a text, someone stole your phone. That's kind of what happens when you're walking a dog and you don't let them sniff. Humans don't seem to recognize that we could be interacting with other species as much as we do. And this kind of learning about how animals survive in what is a multi-species and multicultural environment, I think might help us understand better how we can thrive in our own multicultural environments when we're just dealing with human cultures, but also our multicultural, multi-species environment.
The Agenda with Steve Paikin is made possible through generous philanthropic contributions from viewers like you. Thank you for supporting TVO's journalism.